in the dressing room with pianist Jonathan Biss, who just completed a performance of Mozart's Piano Concerto in B-flat major, Kershaw Listing 595, the last of his 27 concerti. Congratulations, fantastic performance.
Thank you very much.
This particular concerto was his last, published or at least made available by January of 1791. We don't know whether Mozart actually performed it or not, do we?
No, and I mean, I think being so late, it's no longer within that period where he was producing piano concerto after piano concerto and playing them, and where, you know, his popularity was such that there was this great demand for a new concerto. So this piece in many ways, I think, exists outside of that parade of masterpieces that are all, you know, so well known and well loved, and even though they're different from one another, they have certain features in common. This is, in many ways, I would say, an outlier among the mature Mozart concerti.
The key is kind of misleading. It's a sunny key, but there's a certain amount of melancholy in the work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think maybe the greatest genius of Mozart throughout is that every human emotion is contained in the music, existing side by side, from the greatest joy to the greatest, as you say, melancholy, nostalgia. And I think maybe in this piece, they're closer to one another than ever before, that they're even in something which is on the surface a major key, sort of simple, open melody. There's always loss is lurking just underneath the surface.
Yeah, and considering that the concerto he had done just before at the coronation is a much more stentorian work.
Yeah, there's almost nothing in common between the two pieces. And this, I mean, of course, it's so easy, maybe too easy, knowing that this is at least part of the piece is written close to the end of his life, to see it as a leave-taking or as a looking back. But I don't know, just in the music itself, I find it hard to play the piece, to listen to the piece, and not to hear this sense of resignation and of this quality of that one hopefully finds in maturity of not needing to try so hard anymore. There's this feeling, you know, in so many of the earlier concertos, there's this brilliance about them. I'm not even talking particularly about instrumental brilliance, but there's this way in which he can turn a phrase, which I think is meant to sort of take your breath away. And this concerto takes your breath away, but not in that kind of way. It's so stripped down to the essentials of what matters, you know, what matters in life, what matters in an interior life. And that's why it's really such a privilege to play, and why it's frightening to play also, because you're exposed to such a degree. I guess I would say that, you know, I feel when I play this that any human failing of mine will be audible.
You're one of the busier concert artists out there, and I wanted to ask about this. You've got a lot of Beethoven in your repertoire. You're recording all of the sonatas for EMI, I understand. Is that completed yet?
No, I'm recording all the sonatas. I've just made the fifth volume out of what will be 9 ultimately, and that's going to be released in a few months. And so I guess I'm exactly at the halfway point at this juncture, and that's obviously a massive undertaking, which means that Beethoven is in my life daily. And I have to say that makes it all the more miraculous to come to Mozart, because, you know, they lived in roughly the same time. I mean, in the arc of history, the difference in chronology is nothing between Mozart and Beethoven. And yet they have nothing in common, basically, in terms of their deepest natures. The sources of drama in the music are so unrelated, and it's kind of an amazing thing after dealing with Beethoven, with Beethoven's sense of fight and his gruffness and his willing the world to be what he wants it to be and needs it to be, and fighting his way towards that. And that's not how Mozart works. Mozart is much more of a realist. The beauty of his music is really about this incredibly clear-eyed vision of how things are, how people act, and how people feel, and how they dream. And it's somehow, again, all of this time I'm spending with Beethoven makes Mozart seem all the more extraordinary.
Well, I think Beethoven, if you read what he wrote and said, I think he knew what his legacy was going to be. I think he honestly knew what it was going to be. And you see it in the piano sonatas because they evolved over the years, and it necessitated the changes in the piano that were happening even as he was alive.
Absolutely. And I don't know, it's so interesting. I could, of course, be wrong, but I feel through playing all of Beethoven's music, or much of it, obviously, that I do know him, that somehow his personality is stamped into that music. And I love Mozart every bit as much as Beethoven, but as a person, he's remained so much more opaque to me. There's something, it's like Shakespeare. It's just someone with this uncanny, one in a billion gift for recording human nature in art, you know, in notes for Mozart and words for Shakespeare. But we don't know anything about it. I mean, we famously don't know hardly anything about Shakespeare. And I feel that there's something similar about Mozart. He just had this eye, an ear, you know, that helped him understand what was what and know how to translate it into music.
Jonathan Biss, thanks so much for spending some time with us, and bravo on the Mozart.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.